and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Hello everybody, welcome to another episode of Lunching with Lawyers. Again, I'm at a conference and today I'm at the Financial Counselling Association Queensland conference and I've managed to corner Teresa Corbin. Teresa is a co-founder and was CEO of ACAN, Australia's peak body for communications consumers. She has many years of experience working in telecommunications policy, both in Australia and internationally. She recently joined Telstra as their chief customer advocate. And no, she's not a lawyer, but many would be surprised that she is not, given the influence that she has had on policy development in the telecommunications in this country over the last 20 years. I first met Teresa when I was involved with the Consumers Telecommunications Network, the precursor organisation to ACAN over 20 years ago. We have also spent many years together when we were the consumer representative on the committee tasked with developing the first mobile premium services code. Welcome, Teresa.
Thanks, Loretta.
I usually ask my interviewees for a biography or a resume, but since you didn't provide one, I had to go hunting on the internet for the information about you. And I found out quite a lot about you, including where you were born. And you weren't born in Australia, were you?
Oh, no. Well, my parents actually met in Papua New Guinea. They were missionaries. And my father was an academic and he was an agricultural person and he was about to go and do a scholarship in California to do his PhD. And so my mother and he got married in Melbourne and headed off to California where my older brother and I were born.
And was your mum already pregnant on the way over? Or?
Well, not that she's ever admitted to.
And so is that why your family moved to New Zealand and then back to Australia?
Actually, my mum was a nurse and so she was did do some nursing when she was in the States. But she was horrified at the health system even back in the 60s. And she said even then that she just could not bear staying in the US and raising a family. And so my father got an academic role in Auckland at Auckland University. And so, yes, we moved to New Zealand then and the rest of the family were born. So I'm one of five children. So,
and that would have been quite challenging for your mother travelling around with all those children in the 60s.
It really was back then. It was quite hard, I think, because her family were all in Melbourne and my father's family were in Sydney. So we had no extended family and really the community that provided support for our family, if there was any, was the Catholic Church. And so we had some very, very good friends that we made during that time. But my mother went through a really, really hard time. We were in New Zealand for 13 years. And during that time, my father was diagnosed with bipolar illness. And so it was a very difficult period. My father was quite abusive and violent at times when he was unwell. And my mother left him many, many times. And she didn't have the family support over there. So eventually she came back to Australia.
By herself or was she still?
So my grandparents came to New Zealand and they realised how terrible the situation was. At that point, my parents had separated and there was quite a lot of challenges still going on. My father would break into the house regularly, steal the car, all sorts of terrible things would be happening. Police would be searching for him. And, you know, my grandparents really realised how terrible the situation was. And my grandfather, who worked in shipping as a you know, in a foundry. So he was just a manual worker, labourer. He used his retirement funds to help us come back to Australia with my mother.
Wow. Because it must have been quite bad if the police were involved, because it wasn't really something that the police got involved in domestic violence situations in the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, so this was actually during the late 70s, and then we did come back to Australia in 1981. Yeah, it was really hard. My brother and I would often escape down the street, find pay phones and ring for help, or even knock on neighbours' doors. I remember once we ran all the way to the convent and asked for help. But the thing that was really hard was that in those days there wasn't any support, and so quite often my mother would be convinced to go back. And it was an awful situation. And when my father became abusive towards us as the children, then my mother decided that was just too much, that it had to stop. And I think that by then there were enough people in the community that had realised that something was wrong.
I didn't know that about you, Teresa. It would have been quite... It's a lifelong legacy, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, no.
You don't get over that.
It certainly takes you a long time to place yourself in that, and the trauma that that plays out doesn't stop when you escape from that situation. My poor mother went through a lot of trouble, even dealing with the fallout from five children who are still very traumatised. Mm. And even to this day, now my mother has passed away and my father, myself and my siblings don't have any contact with each other because there's just too much trauma involved.
And so did you get a relationship again with your father in later life? Or
I saw him quite a few times, and my younger sibling, my brother, who had less bad memories, had more contact with him. He got better treatment as life went on, and at various times I did have quite interesting engagement with him, and I was able to place it as he was ill, whereas I think that others in my family suffered differently and weren't able to release it in the same way. And so I think that was very, very hard for them. Their trauma and their recovery hasn't been the same. And their engagement with him. So we've all had engagement with him as adults, but it's been different for all of us.
Isn't it funny? You can have the same family, the same experiences, yeah, but react to them very differently, or take lessons from it, or be traumatised very differently.
Because people are different. Mm. People's personalities are different, and their abuse is suffered differently. There are things that happen to my siblings that I don't know about. And even as an adult, I still found out about. And it's quite shocking. It's quite difficult to accept, especially if there's even frustration on their level that you didn't suffer the same way, you know, or that you didn't come out of it in the same way. So there can be a lot of jealousy. There can be a lot of anger. And it's really, really hard to move on as an adult in that regard, even if you're not responsible for that abuse and you want to fix it. Sometimes you can't fix it.
No, that's true. You can't fix it. Teresa, I was going to ask you, though, that you from the very beginning, I think, had a very strong social justice, personality, you know, like steeped in social justice. Do you think that was part of the Catholic upbringing or your... or the upbringing of the family?
I think I've thought about that a lot. I think... there's definitely an element. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but there's obviously a social justice angle that's very strong in that kind of upbringing. And I think my mother had very strong social justice conscience. And even though my father was sick, I think he did too. So I think there was definite values that came through in that regard. But I also think that as I grew older and when I went to university, the first year I got a free education, but the following year tertiary fees were introduced and I was incensed. I just couldn't understand how unfair that was. And I hadn't really had much of a political education. Mm-hmm. And so I really started to learn a lot more about inequality and why it existed and how it could change and how it should change. And so I think that there was probably seeds that were planted as a child, but then ultimately it was just watching how that played out in reality in the Australia in the 80s, and that my concerns for, you know, the future. And I also did quite a bit of work overseas with Community Aid Abroad. I went on some study tours. So I really learnt a lot when I was at university, and I really just felt that I had some responsibility to try and change the world and try and be, you know, even though in my small way, that you could change things and you could make a difference to other people's lives, and it was important.
And you had that opportunity really early. But I was going to ask you, you went to La Trobe University. What did you study there?
Yeah, so I my plan was that I wanted to, because I was very interested in travel, I was very interested in languages, and I wanted to travel the world as an English teacher, so I enrolled to study linguistics. And I went to La Trobe because the only other place I could study was at Monash, and it was just too hard for me to travel there. I was still living at home with my mum, actually in a caravan in the backyard. And so I went to La Trobe, but it turned out to be a great decision because I got the opportunity to study First Nations languages and just learn a bit more about Australia's, you know, First Nations cultures.
Gee, that would have been quite interesting, because now we're becoming a lot more aware of our First Nations history, perhaps in the last 10 years. But this was the late 80s, early 90s. That would have been quite unusual for Australia.
Yeah. So growing up in New Zealand, I had a lot of friends who were Maori and who were Polynesian. And so I had more multicultural engagement at school. And so when I came to Australia, I was really just expecting that Australia's Indigenous people would be mixed in with my school friends, and I was really shocked. There was absolutely no First Nations fellow students. And so that sort of meant that I started to ask questions from an early age, like in my, you know, 15 or 16, about what happened in Australia. And I was learning Australian history for the first time, because I'd only really learned New Zealand history. And I was quite shocked that we didn't learn much about, you know, what happened with colonisation. And because it was quite different. I mean, even though New Zealand's not perfect either, you do get more of a bicultural education. And I did learn how to, you know, speak some Maori, and I did, you know, understand Maori cultural practices at a very basic level, whereas you don't get any of that, or you didn't get any of that in the 80s or 70s in Australia. And so when I got the opportunity to learn something, I really welcomed it.
That's great, Teresa. We'll see how that noise goes in the background too. So can you speak any First Nations?
No, so you know, you always get that question when you study linguistics at university. So really, when you're studying linguistics, you're studying the theory of language, and, you know, you're studying, you know, how to teach language as a second language. You might be learning how to record a language, and many of the people that were teaching us about First Nations languages had actually worked with communities to try and preserve and maintain languages that were ultimately really endangered and being lost. And so my you know, next thing of what was I going to do next in life was I desperately wanted to go and work in a community and record their language and work with them. But over time, as my political awareness grew, I was also quite upset that in order to get a PhD in that way, you really had to basically take someone's traditional knowledge and then claim it as your own. So no, I don't know how to speak any First Nations languages, but I do know a lot about the grammar of First Nations languages, and I learnt a lot more about culture, and that was quite helpful later on. And having said that, like, I still have an awful lot to learn about Australia's First Nations cultures. And one thing that's really significantly different from New Zealand to Australia is in Australia we have hundreds of countries and hundreds of languages and cultural groups. In New Zealand, you just have one Maori language and one Maori nation. So it actually does make it much harder to preserve, to support, and, you know, even to understand. And in some ways, it also meant that the destruction that was a result of colonisation was even more devastating for so many people.
And not capable of being reconstituted,
reclaimed,
reclaimed.
You know, having said that, the Palawa people in Tasmania have actually been doing some amazing things, even with what is still left. So there is still possibility, and there should still be support for those kinds of initiatives. I was just going to say, one of the things that is really awesome nowadays is that there are a lot of First Nations linguists that are actually recording their own languages, and that it's much more ethical study practices that are put in place than were back then, which is one of the reasons why I really stepped away from it and just thought, okay, that's even though that might be your first love, that's not what you're going to do in the future.
Mm. Can I... you became very active in student politics because of the introduction of fees into the HECS scheme, which now seems quite cheap as to what a university degree costs these days.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask you, you became president of the Student Representative Council. What do you think was your most significant achievement in that role?
Oh, that's a really good question. Sometimes I felt really frustrated at the end of those years of whether or not I'd actually really achieved anything. I think that the biggest achievement probably was that a group of us built a movement of awareness among people that weren't politically aware previously, including myself, and who are probably far more engaged now in all sorts of social change exercises throughout Australia that would never have happened. So as much as tertiary fees are still there and they're worse than they were and we weren't successful in that regard, I think we created a whole generation of activists. We created a whole generation of people that went into the union movement, some who went into government, you know, that are actually politicians now. And then people like myself who decided, well, we're going to go and have a career in the not-for-profit sector and make a contribution to you know, changing the world in a different way. I mean, there were other things like, you know, there's institutional changes we made, you know, like I contributed to the establishment of the National Union of Students, the same as many, many people in my generation of student activists did. There were lots of things like, you know, we created a cultural exchange between the Philippines and Australia. We made it, you know, it seems crazy now, but we actually had a payment plan for the admin fee. We had an admin fee for a couple of years before before HECS came in. And we created a payment plan because at our university there was more women than any other university, and we knew that and there were more mature age students, so we knew that they were going to be impacted more than other universities. And I actually think the fact that HECS is HECS and not an upfront fee was probably an achievement, even though I hated HECS. It did still mean that people could get into education, even though it still does mean that lots of people decide not to have a university education because they don't want that debt.
Or I think one of the interesting things is that if you've got a huge debt is whether you can make a choice to go into the not-for-profit sector when your degrees are costing you a fortune.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, I had a debt of $10,000, which seems tiny now. And the reality is, my degree took longer because I was involved in activism and then I had a family. So I would have loved it if we had have done something like managed to get a deferred payment arrangement for parents, you know. We didn't think of anything like that at the time. And
you were pretty young.
I know, but you think about it now, you go, well, that's frustrating because we could have negotiated, but we took a really hard line. You know, no, we don't want fees at all, you know, rather than trying to evolve the system. And I think there's still probably a lot of room to improve the way that HECS operates. Because you're right, that affected me being able to buy a house. It affected my work choices. It affected so many things. And to be perfectly frank, there was many, many years when I was earning so little that I didn't actually make any contribution to paying it back, and it was just accruing.
In fact, I was in a similar situation. I only had a very small HECS debt, $5,000 for my final year or something. But it was interesting because I was on such a low income for so many years. The first year I had to pay it back was actually when I separated from my husband, and it was probably the time when I needed it the most, income.
Exactly. Mm. And so it also affected, I did a master's at one point. I only completed 1 year because the following year they decided that this master's degree was so lucrative because it was in IT, and made it upfront full fees. So I'd never finish my master's. you know, there was always impact as a result of being able to access education because of the fact that fees are now there.
So one of the things that was really interesting that you just said was that when you started on this campaign, you just went no to fees. And now you said, you know, we could have worked on evolving the scheme. Is that how you now practice or how you now think about things?
I do. Like, yeah. I learned, I think, over time, and it wasn't just something I learned as a student activist. It was also something I learned as a consumer representative, that ultimately, you know, it's pretty hard to get your big, huge ask every single time. It's really important to argue very hard for it and to have that in principle position and that goal that you're aiming for, because you never know, you might win it, right?
Yeah.
But you do need to have, you know, what are your fallbacks? What are things that can make something better? That can be quite hard, because sometimes the people that are working with you don't want to accept that. And so, you know, it can be quite controversial even with your allies and who you're working with to move forward into that space. And also you have to be quite tactical as to when you roll that out, you know, because and you and I know sometimes we've been in committees, we've had to take a very hard line and take some, you know, potentially what might be perceived as militant action by removing ourselves from certain, you know, conversations. However, you know, you have to judge those tactics based on the situation at the time and the issue, you know, the actual issue.
No, I agree. Do you think that the so I'm going to go back to the National Union of Students. Do you think it's lived up to its remit?
Look, no. And I think that so the big challenge for any sort of National Union of Students is that you have a big machine, even in student politics, that feeds, you know, politics in Australia, right? So it basically trains up the politicians that are going to, you know, take the reins in the future. So it's a sandpit, you know, and I hate that about it. And I ultimately, it was my engagement in the National Union of Students in its first years that actually turned me off politics and being in politics, because I didn't really like taking a caucus line. I didn't really like the fact that, you know, you either, you know, joined a caucus and towed the line or didn't join the caucus and towed the line. I didn't really like the fact that people were just there for a career, that for me it was about changing things and changing the world and getting outcomes. And that's really different. Having said that, right, I do think it's important to have career politicians, but I think you need more of a mix. And I think we're starting to see that in Australian politics.
Really?
Yeah, we are. Like we're saying, look at Jackie Lambie, you know. We've had a couple of other very interesting politicians.
Oh, and especially now the independents.
Yeah. Helen Haynes, she's a nurse. You know, so we are starting to see other walks of life. And I think you need career politicians who understand the system, right, and can use it well. But you also need other people with other life experiences, including people that maybe haven't been in employment, maybe they've been carers, you know. You just need people with different perspectives.
That have lived experience, yes. I think, of different walks of life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So did you finish that degree in linguistics?
I did. I finished the degree. I didn't finish my honours. I started my honours. But that year was the year I got divorced. So, I had children while I was studying. So I had children quite young, 23, started a family. And because my degree had taken longer, because I had done other things. And also, I think probably also around that time in life was when I was really starting to deal with the trauma of my childhood. So, it probably didn't affect me so much in high school because I was very focused on. This is not going to affect us. We're just going to get on with life. But probably by the time I'd left home, it started to really play out on me. And obviously my ex-partner also had his own challenges in life. And as it turned out, we didn't work out, you know. And we were very young, so life was quite challenging for a few years there.
How old were you? How old were the kids when you separated?
So the kids were not quite two and not quite four. So
that would have been very difficult.
Yeah, and it was a situation I never thought I'd find myself in.
I bet you.
You know, I was like, oh, this is not going to happen to me. It happened to Mum, not going to happen to me. But yes, So it was a bit of a reality check.
And how did you deal with it? Because I remember when I separated and a friend of mine said to me, she separated much at the same time, and she goes, Loretta, we're single mums now. And, you know, the stigma around that, I mean, it wasn't quite as bad in the 2000s, but this would have been in the 90s.
Yeah, this was in the 90s.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know that I was so concerned about the stigma. I was quite shocked at myself. I didn't realise I had a white picket fence perspective, but maybe I did, you know. And, you know, we hadn't got married, but then we did get married because we were my ex's parents weren't very happy, and the marriage certificate didn't matter to me, so I was happy to do it if it made them happy.
Mm.
But really, there was a lot more issues to all of that than, you know, so it probably wasn't a great decision. we were just finishing our degrees, and so we hadn't actually really started careers, and we didn't have much money at all. And in actual fact, what actually happened was I started my honours degree, and I had got a bit of a scholarship, not much, a tiny bit, but enough to sort of justify that I could keep studying. And I was doing really well. And my ex-partner was very unhappy because he was at the Jeff Kennett years. There was no employment. There was no teaching jobs. There was nothing. Mm. And so the generation that came out during Jeff Kennett years really suffered badly in Victoria. And so I often say I'm a Jeff Kennett refugee because I came to New South Wales to keep working in the community sector. And basically that's because that's where you could get a job and the same for my ex-partner. He was in drug and alcohol rehabilitation. That's where he got work. And
so why you moved from Melbourne.
Yeah, lots of reasons why we moved. We always thought we wanted to live in a warmer climate, and we were on good enough terms that we had agreed that whoever got a job in either Queensland or Sydney first, we would both move, and the other would find a job. So I got a job at the Consumers Telecommunications Network, and he went into drug and alcohol rehabilitation work in Redfern. And so I think he always wanted to move further north, and he's done that now. So, yeah.
And so how did you get that role at CTN?
Well, it was interesting because I was working as a manager in a student union, and I didn't really want to stay in management. I kind of did eventually, but I wanted to be sort of heading up a not-for-profit rather than student union. And so I knew that I needed to get more background in research and policy. And so I didn't want to work full-time because I was a single mum by then, and I just needed more time with the kids. And ultimately the kids were still really my first priority rather than a career. And I wanted to keep doing something that was relevant to me, but at the same time that they would be, you know, was flexible enough for the kids. And so I saw this role advertised as a communications liaison officer. So working with the community sector and really explaining digital divide issues and telecommunications issues to representatives that were involved in the Telstra consumer consultative processes.
I'm going to interrupt you there because I saw a little video of you talking about your first modem and the speeds of your modem. You were quite interested in telecommunications and digital technology from a very young age.
Yeah.
What piqued your interest in that area?
My mum, this is a real side story, isn't it? So my mum had a really good friend whose husband worked at IBM in New Zealand. And sometimes on school holidays, I got to go into IBM in Auckland, and I got to sit on some of the computers that he was using and do text chatting. So this is in the 70s.
Really?
Yes, with people who were playing a version of probably what ended up being Dungeons and Dragons or something. But, you know, so I'd only get to sort of type something out a few times and see them typing it back, and understood that there was people on the other world doing this, and it was really exciting and interesting. And then when I was at school, I had the opportunity to do an elective for 6 months on programming and DOS, And at a girls' school, that was a big deal. And, you know, Catholic girls' school, nobody really wanted to do it. There was like five nerds that picked it. And we spent all term learning how to write a program to pick random numbers. And then we had to fill in data cards with pencil to you know, basically our dots and zeros to run our program. And we had to get the colouring into these squares exactly right, because if we didn't, then we only had one go, because we only had one computer and we only had one go all term to run our program. So we had to get it perfect. So anyway, that kind of whet my interest, those two things.
Isn't that funny? Because I was really shocked, because not only two things that you just picked up there, the opportunity and the fact that no one had any access to digital technology in the 70s and 80s, and the other thing was that you were a woman or a girl, and it's not the sort of thing that girls
I had to really struggle to get information about these sorts of things and talk about them. So I read lots of this, and I think if I had my time again as a linguist, because in linguistics you can do computational linguistics, and at that point in time nobody would believe in the 80s that we can do what we can do now with voice recognition. Or even natural language creation, nobody would, because that was actually deemed to be impossible back in the 80s. And you could go and study courses that were working towards working these things out in the US, but I had kids, you know, and life took another direction. But I think if life, I could see myself doing that in another life, you know.
Can I just say, but who would have thought that a degree in linguistics would get you a career in telecommunications?
But it's actually relevant. It's completely relevant.
I'm sure it is, Teresa.
Well, you know, because the thing about linguistics, right, people don't realise, you study sociology, you study history, you study psychology, you study science, you study all sorts of humanities topics. You also study acoustics and physics.
Mm.
And so it's a really diverse degree, unlike many others.
Well, so says Teresa. And all those linguistic departments across the country will be very pleased with that endorsement from Teresa Corbin. But I'm going back now to CTN. So that role evolved and you ended up becoming the CEO of CTN at some stage.
Yep.
And what was the driver for then establishing ACAN?
So
and tell me what ACAN was.
So I was obviously very passionate about digital inclusion issues, and I still am, because I really believe that if people have good access to technology, whatever their challenges in life, they can actually be enabled to overcome many of those as a result of being able to use digital technology, right? So probably that's what's been the passion that's kept me going on these things all the time. And so CTN was very poorly funded. We got funding initially through Telstra, so it used to provide the secretariat for their consumer consultative councils, which then evolved into obviously, Telstra was the only provider then. Then there were many, many providers. We had competition come into the marketplace. And my predecessor at CTN had managed to get, with many others, an amendment to the Telco Act that allowed consumer representation and research to be funded. So the head of power was in the legislation, but then the minister still had to decide, yeah, okay, we'll give it some money. So they put aside $800,000, and that was a pie of money in 1998. That just kept getting split more and more every year. So the slices got thinner and thinner. And CTN originally got the largest slice and did the broadest pieces of work. Yeah. All of the work on self-regulation, all of the work with making sure that vulnerable consumers didn't get left behind, all of that was done through CTN. There's also a small business organisation that was funded and a group that worked with people with disabilities. And there was umpteen different research projects. So there was huge problems with the funding. It was only on an annual basis, and you had to pitch for it regularly. A lot of reporting. Yeah. And not really, you know, trying to balance that with actually getting the outcomes was problematic. So when the Rudd government came in, they Senator Stephen Conroy was the Minister for Communications, and he really wanted to change things up because there was massive complaints about telecommunications. They were out of control.
Oh, yeah, they were too.
Yeah, so close to 200,000 complaints a year were going to the Ombudsman. they wanted to build a national broadband network. And they realised that there was a massive issue with not having adequate support for the consumer voice in telecommunications. And so they basically brought the industry, consumers, all, you know, the regulators, all of the different groups together, all the stakeholders, and sat down and went, how can we come up with a better model? And so there was a special working group that was established, and we did lots of consultation, and ultimately the model was ACAN. It has a very interesting name. I often say it's the name that you get if you were going to design a camel, because if you spell out what ACAN means, it's very frustrating because it's the Australian Communications Consumer Action Network, which is very long. But that domain name, ACCAN, was available. So acan.org.au, unlike many other A names in the domain name space. And so, you know, it was a committee that decided this name, and we decided it doesn't matter what the name is. Ultimately, we're going to become this amazing umbrella organisation. And so that's how it was started. And in 2009, we got $2 million per annum funding, which was basically, for CTN, it was 10 Asia. Times the funding than they were getting previously. And CTN formed the core of what then became a much larger organisation, and CTN decided to fold and hand over its corporate knowledge and staff and property to ACAN.
And so you went to ACAN as the deputy CEO, yeah. Losing out to Alan Asher. Yeah. I can understand why they were happy to have Alan Asher. Yeah, it's a pretty unbelievable
Definitely.
CV. Well, but at the same time, it would have been quite disappointing for you.
Well, yeah, it was a little bit, because there were times when, and I was just telling this to someone recently, so CTN nearly folded several times because we lost funding a few times, significant amounts of funding. So 1 year we only had just over $100,000 funding, and we lost our executive director then, and we downsized to 1.6 staff members, and I was one of them. And the opportunity was for me to basically step up and become the acting executive officer, but I had to take a pay cut, so from being a policy officer. So for 6 months, my family really made the decision with me, my new partner, and I decided, no, look, it's worth it, because it's important work and you get flexibility. So, you know, once again, I was making a big decision that impacted my family, to change the world, really. And I'm glad we did, because if we didn't, then CTN would have probably folded. We built CTN back up again, and then as a result of that, it formed the core of this larger organisation. So I guess my point is that I was disappointed for my family, because I felt that I owed them, you know, that I should I should step up and earn a bit more money and, you know, all that kind of thing. And I hadn't actually bought a house at that point in our life, and we were still renting, and, you know, all sorts of things I felt quite guilty about, because I'd given up a lot of time to create ACAN and to do lots of things that were focused on that, not them. But my family were actually great about it. They were fine. They were more worried about me. And the reality is, if I had been faced with the decision of Alan Asher applies for the job and Theresa Corbyn applies for the job, I'm going to pick Alan Asher, right? And I actually really relished the opportunity to work with Alan for a year and a half or 13 months, whatever it was. It was probably a year and a half by the time we started and finished, because he was older than me. He had a lot more experience. I had things to learn, and it was nice.
And what did he teach you? So what do you think he taught
you? It was interesting. Interesting you should ask me that question, because I wanted to just step back and observe how someone else did it. Did they hit their head against the same brick walls that I had, you know, in the telco industry? And yes, he did.
Yeah.
And did, you know, in his strategies of trying different things, did it work? Was the way that I did things okay? You know, so there was lots of questions that, and I did have a big crisis of confidence to start with. You know, there's no question. But at the same time, I also got the opportunity to really focus in on the operational side of ACAN and to really think about how that could be set up really well. And I'm really pleased to have had that opportunity, because Alan could take the, you know, the front step with the media and all the attention that we were getting, and the big issues, you know, and raise the profile of an organisation to make it more effective. So I learned things about profile. I learned things probably more about myself and how I handled that situation than anything else, because I had to deal with a lot of people being disappointed that I also didn't get the role, you know, people in our sector, you know.
I was slightly disappointed myself, so.
I know, but, like, truthfully, like, if you just have a rational or an emotional reaction, you'd pick Alan because of his experience. And I think it was good for ACAN. I mean, the telcos might have a different view, but I actually think that it was good for ACAN that he took the role.
Mm. Yeah, but once you became CEO, you made that position your own.
Yeah, I think so. And so when Alan was leaving, he said to me, I'm sure he won't mind me sharing this, but he said to me, oh, well, you have to apply again. I said, well, I'm not doing that again. That was just terrible. I didn't get it last time. Why would I get it this time? And he said, oh, no. He said, you absolutely have to get the role. And then he said, so, right, well, I want you to get a management coach. And I was like, well, they do that in corporates. They don't do that in not-for-profits. And he said, no, they do it in not-for-profits too. And he said, don't come back to have another meeting with me until you give me a name of who we're going to get to be your management coach. And he said, you've got 3 months, because 3 months is how long notice I've given. Mm-hmm. And every day for a week, he said, so who is it? Who is it? And eventually I did go to an organisation called Matrix On Board, which many people probably know. And I'm really pleased I did, because it was an opportunity for me to think about my management style, think about why I wanted to be heading up a not-for-profit, you know, what could I offer? What were the things that I would bring to it? And, yes, it was different to how Alan would do it, but that was okay.
Isn't that amazing? I never knew that you went to a management coach.
I felt really strange, but it was the first time anybody really invested in me in that way.
And it's an like you said, it is an investment. Mm. And I don't think not-for-profits do that well, or you're often thrust into a management position.
That's right.
And you don't have any of the training, and then can really step up.
Look, even if Alan Asher had not applied for the same job as me a year and a half or whatever earlier, I'm actually glad I didn't get the job the first time, because I learned a lot in that 13 months after that about all sorts of things. And it gave me opportunities that I would not have had otherwise, and I probably wouldn't have gained the same understanding for maybe another 5 years about things.
Oh, good on you. And so what are some of the campaigns or advocacy that you're most proud of in that telecommunications space whilst you were at ACAN? I know you're going to say it was all a team effort, and yes, I agree. Right. But as as the leader of that organisation.
Yeah. Do you know what I actually am most proud of? And I hope that this is something that ACAN really continues. I'm really proud of how inclusive ACAN is. Because ACAN has steeped in its DNA from so many people with disabilities working with CTN and then ACAN, that everything has to be really inclusive, nothing about us without us, that people with disabilities are represented from board down, that, you know, even there are regularly many different staff members that have worked for ACAN that have disabilities, that live with disability. So that really pleases me. Because I think that other consumer organisations and not-for-profits still struggle with that, and I think that we could do better as a sector in that regard.
Can I ask you something about, because you talked about the politics, how did you manage those politics? Because I know that in the disability space it's pretty pretty robust, but also in just community advocacy it's pretty robust as well.
Look, I think you have to have an awareness about these things and understanding. But it's the same with anything. If you're trying to get change, you need to understand things, but you also can't get too caught up by it. Mm. So disability sector has lots of politics. Rural and regional sector has lots of politics. Yeah. There's lots of different sectors that any peak body engages with that you actually need to just appreciate and I think respect, have a healthy respect. You know, and you're not a player in that, but you do need all of those players to work with you to get the changes that you're trying to get. So don't be a player in that space, but, you know, try and appreciate why they may not come on board fully, or why they may not be able to support you on one thing, but they might support you on another thing. And I think that's another thing too, is just to respect the differences. So sometimes you have to list out who. You can't always say all of ACAN backs all of this, or all of this Peabody backs all this. Sometimes it's important to list people out that are the backers.
Mm.
And that's all right. Like, it's okay. And then the next thing, it might be something slightly different. And also, if there's a key reason why somebody's not supporting you or a priest, sometimes it's actually important to actually highlight and advocate and explain that on their behalf, like, not in the sense of an attack, but this group's not here because for them this issue is maybe not number one, right?
Yeah.
Or for them, they're struggling with funding right now and they, you know, they need to focus on that. Or for them, we need to, you know,
they want to go a lot further.
Yeah, they want to go harder or whatever. Mm. So I think just acknowledge it and don't fight it because, I mean, that's part of the democracy, isn't it, that we all work in.
Well, it's interesting because you said about that's what you really hated about student politics, was that thing about having to crook us and hard line and you're either in the tent or you're out. And
so this is one thing about alliances that you have to work out and realise, and maybe I did learn this young, I don't know, but I really learnt it at ACAN, that if you want to build alliances, then you need to appreciate the difference as well as what you agree on.
You just that's true. For sure. And I really do think that ACAN has been very inclusive. I mean, that's how... Well, I first became involved in CTM, but I think it was because of a disability.
Yeah, I think so, because you were representing people with intellectual disabilities on a few different things,
And I think that's how...
Because of your experience with work and personal as well.
So... Yeah, and it was, and in fact, it was, it was quite an interesting time. I found that to become steeped a little bit into the disability sector was quite interesting, particularly from my point of view, because myself, I don't have a disability, but I have a child with a disability. So getting that, making sure that I respected that I didn't necessarily have the personal lived experience, but I certainly had it from the perspective of having a child with a disability.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was very surprised and very quite gratified as to how that sector really accepted me, particularly in those meetings with Communications Alliance over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. But were there any campaigns or advocacy that you particularly wanted to... You don't have to.
So, what about the one that you and I worked on? You know, like every time I see somebody do a text message stop to some kind of, you know, spam that they're receiving, I think of you and I, because you and I came up with that concept, you know?
And I keep forgetting all this stuff. Like, and sometimes it really surprises me when people come up to me and you go, they say things like, do you know you can write stop and they'll stop this? And I'm going, oh, we were part of
getting that. Didn't we suggest that? Yes. No, there's lots of things like that. I mean,
but how things have moved on, like when you talk about, because we were involved in that mobile premium services code, but that's how quickly the industry is moving, that really where cost was such a big issue, those sorts of things are probably not as much in the mobile space.
And, you know, that's what's, it is really hard when you work in social change to step back and go, okay, achieved, because all you were ever thinking about is what wasn't achieved. Mm. And so because that's where your eye is always on the goal of what you really want. So, okay, so one of the catch cries for ACAN is available, affordable, accessible. Well, on the available, there's no question that all our availability has increased, right? But the truth is we're still behind. You know, we've still not basically got, you know, universal coverage. We still have quite a bit of struggle with reliability that, you know, mobile's patchy in many, many places and broadband is not great. Many people are still relying on satellite services. So, and people who are homeless still have challenges, right? So on accessibility, I think we've made the most progress. And the reason I reckon we've made the most progress with accessibility is because the big equipment developers realised over time that actually universal design was better for everyone. So Siri, great for a blind person, but also great for everyone else who's driving or whatever, you know. So there's quite a lot of gains and advances in accessibility because I think universal design has been seen as something that will grow the market, grow the usage, Having said that, there's still an awful lot of work to do in that space too.
We have to be careful though. I was listening to somebody the other day about universal design because I bang on about it all the time.
Yeah.
Financial services as well. And this one person piped up and said, particularly about documents and plain English, they said it's often not appropriate for migrant people because it's not necessarily that they don't understand, they just need the understanding in their language. So just simplifying it to such an extent that it would be accessible to someone with an intellectual disability doesn't necessarily make it appropriate for everybody. Yeah. So it was quite an interesting
take. The one I feel the worst about not having much achieved enough is affordability. There's still such a patchwork and there's still some people who can't afford telecommunications. I think we've improved the consumer protection around, you know, whether or not, because you used to be able to sell things and say it was $0 when it wasn't. Well, you can't do that anymore, you know, and the complaint handling standard is a standard now. There still needs to be more enforcement and there needs to be more resources for the enforcement agency to follow up. And then it goes into all... Why did I go to Telstra? But, you know, I'm sure you're going to ask me that question.
I will. But before I even get to that, actually, I will ask you something about that. But I was going to ask you the role of mentors. You've had some great mentors in Philippa Smith and Deidre O'Donnell and I'm sure in Alan Asher as
Johanna
well.
Johanna Plant.
What makes good mentors and how do you think you've been most effective to your own mentees?
Okay, well, what makes a great mentor is somebody actually cares about you. And actually, so it's more than just, a thing that you're going to do. It's you're actually invested in the person. So the question, and it's about them. And, you know, it's one of these classic things of, what do you get out of it? Well, I get out of it the fact that I'm helping someone and I like that. And then I get back to sit back and say, well, isn't it awesome what that person's doing now, you know, and feel that you've been part of their life, you know? So that's the quid pro quo, I guess. But the thing is, I think a good mentor actually challenges you as well and sometimes makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable, you know, why are you doing this or why don't you do this or, you know. And also a good mentor is available when you need them because really the people that need mentors are often really, really busy. So I've had some great people who stayed up late talking to me on the phone, you know, talking me through something, just listening, you know, and quite often just validating what I already thought, but just giving me a little bit more confidence. So I think the thing about, and I have had lots of people that I've mentored both as in a structured way and also people that probably didn't realise that that's the relationship we had, but then over time it's emerged and, you know, now I can see them doing wonderful, exciting, great things.
Because it's not the sort of language that we used to use, do we?
That's exactly right. And so, but I get a lot of pleasure out of seeing young people start out, seeing their commitment to social justice and then encouraging them to take that further. And I think that the thing about a great mentor is that they appreciate what your goals are and they help you get there.
Yeah, I think so too. You've been a very high-profile consumer advocate for many years, but you were unable to buy a home until your mid-40s, which was quite some time ago, so not in the current market.
Yeah.
Much of your inability to get into the housing market is, I suspect, the low wages in the community sector for many years. What can we do to make a career in the community sector more financially rewarding to attract young people into the sector, particularly where there's large student debts, cost of living is rising, with ensuring that people who are attracted to this area have that passion?
Well, so getting funding agreements right is absolutely pivotal and getting long-term funding agreements. So we ended up at ACAN getting 5-year. It wasn't initially 3 years, but that was still better than 1 year. So 1 year was one of the problems too. I worked for organisations that only had 1-year funding agreements. So no bank's going to lend you any money.
No.
And also, we just had a very, you know, low, we were earning hardly anything. And my current partner was working in the car industry, which is also equally badly paid at the time.
And very like, again, the banks aren't going to lend you money when you're working on commission.
And also we lived in Sydney. So to work for a peak organisation, many peak organisations live in regional centres and cities where the rent is higher. And that's a reality that needs to be accepted. So one of the things also is that so predominantly we pay award wages. Now the award, the ASU award in New South Wales at least has, the modern award overall has been significantly increased. And there have been like basically increases over many, many years to basically bring it up to some parity. And the assumption being that because many women work in that area, that they're paid less. But the truth of the matter is that that can't stop, and we've reached a point where the threshold is considered to be acceptable, and it probably is just on a par with lower paid government jobs now, which is better than it was when I was first working in the sector. But the truth of the matter is that you still don't get as much superannuation and you don't have the career prospects. So I think there is something to be said about better wages, and we got to the point at ACAM where we created an executive management level where we actually paid above ward, because we had to keep people and also to progress them in their careers. So I think you need to be a bit more creative about wages, but also I made a decision to have less people and pay them more, because I think that's important.
I agree. Is that why you moved to Telstra, Teresa?
No, actually not at all, because like being the head of ACAN, I didn't feel that I was underpaid. And in fact, I would have been...
Well, why did you sell out?
So it wasn't really about wages, and I think that if the HR people at Telstra listen to this, they'll sort of go, oh, well, you know, why are we paying it then? and Andy Penn knows this, because we had this conversation, and I had this conversation with him and a few others at Telstra in the higher levels before I decided to come across. For me, my job is about changing the world and about making a difference, and so whatever job that is. And so I really needed to understand that Telstra had an appetite for that, and I understood that the role that they created was quite different to previous positions and that they were really up for change. So... they did quite a lot to make the role independent, and they do really want me to be the independent voice inside Telstra. So I get to look under the bonnet where I couldn't before and see the things that they say were blockages. Are they really blockages? I can sort of challenge them a bit more from the inside. So I get to continue doing the job I've been doing and hopefully make some other changes. And, okay, it's not just for – it is just for the Telstra customers, but – I'm hoping that Telstra will, you know, lead the market and then, you know, encourage the others. Like, I'm the first customer advocate, chief customer advocate in telco. That's appalling. We should have them in all telcos. So, you know, like, I'm kind of hoping that by making this brave step into the corporate area, it certainly wasn't on my list of to-dos, work for a corporate. Last time I worked for a corporate was when I worked for McDonald's when I was 15, and I pretty much swore that I was never doing it again. So I've eaten my words on that. And hopefully I can make a difference.
I think sometimes people have this perception that you've got to be a consumer advocate outside of large corporations or government even. And I think that's a fallacy. I think you can really make some very good changes within organisations.
Absolutely.
And you know yourself, there's some wonderful people.
Great people. Robert like Morcillo. Robert Morcillo, exactly. And he is one of my mentors too.
He's worked in Telstra for many, many years.
Absolutely.
And would be seen as somebody who really thinks about
consumers. And, you know, what he's been able to achieve on low income measures actually makes me think that it's worth it. You know, he's made a massive contribution to people who wouldn't not otherwise have been able to afford telecommunication services because of what he's done through Telstra and through working in Telstra. And I think that's another thing Deirdre O'Donnell also taught me, and she worked for Optus for a while, that there are good people inside corporations that are trying to make changes. You can't paint everybody with the same brush, and that in order to get change, you need to influence those people. So... you know, that's what I'm going to give a go at and see what happens. And at the same time, I also think that it will make me a better advocate in the long term. So when I stop working for Telstra, I plan to join another organisation and help out, you know?
You've already answered one of the questions that I was going to ask you. What are you going to do next? But you've said it. So what, though, are some of the frustrations of working within a large corporation like Telstra?
It's just huge. Like, so that's part of the problem, is it's so big that you spend a lot of time explaining and advocating to get people across the line on different new initiatives. So it's coming to terms with that and how to work the system in that. So I'm very good at, I know how to work the system for social change, which is a much bigger set of players if you think about it. But now I feel like I've got the same number of players in a smaller arena. However, the scale is still enormous. So trying to appreciate what are the levers to motivate people to change things in Telstra is what I'm really focused on at the moment. So learning, you know, who changes what, who makes what, who deals with what, who does the decisions on this, and then, you know, what are the options and possibilities. And also something that I'm not used to thinking about is, okay, so what's the business proposition in the sense of how does the social justice issue that I want to make a difference on really impact on business? And what does doing responsible business really mean? And I think that there's a lot of people inside Telstra that have the same questions. So hopefully I can work together with them and hopefully work that out a bit better. And, you know, we're doing this amazing, you know, review of the financial assistance support team at the moment, and which used to be called Collections. You know, and it's a name change, but it's a name change, but it's the beginning of reforming things, you know.
It's a completely different way of looking at something.
That's exactly right.
Financial assistance to collections.
That's right. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done with First Nations customers, and we've got our First Nations advocate, Lauren Ganley, who's working on that. And clearly a big steps we've got to make to improve on sales practices and also the support that First Nations customers need. So circling back to linguistics and what I learned many, many years ago and just building on that knowledge because, you know, we're all on a journey in Australia at the moment of bringing up our awareness and knowledge of First Nations Australians and the huge richness and contribution that First Nations Australians have made for thousands of years and continue to make to our country.
So you're the fox in the hen house, but you seem to be doing, or maybe the hen in the
I don't know. We could be either, really. But the good thing is that I do feel that I get heard, and I do feel that you know, I think that that like I said, Telstra's on a journey with all of this, and you know, even if I can just change a couple of little things, I think it will be worth it to have done this. And, yeah, so and also I think that hopefully because traditionally the people who are customer advocates come from two bases. They come from people that have been in complaint handling in an organisation already, or they come from perhaps an ombudsman space. So I'm coming at it from a very different angle because I've been a consumer representative. So, you know, like Telstra, we've both been brave. I've been brave and Telstra's been brave by bringing me in. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, just working out how we what we both want and what we both can do in that space. And I think I'm still sort of, like I said to somebody this morning, today I'm flying, yesterday I wasn't flying. Today, you know, like I'm learning still. Yeah. I've very much got my training wheels on.
Oh, it sounds really great. And I think it's a really good thing to, like you said, it's something that the other telcos could think about as well, about having a customer advocate and really making it something that's quite independent.
Absolutely. Like, so my role, whilst I report to the group executive for sustainability, external affairs and legal, the reality is that I don't get a bonus. I'm independent of business units. I report to the board twice a year. I'm on the audit and risk committee, as in not a full member, but obviously I attend the meetings. And so I have access from board level, CEO level down throughout the organisation. And that visibility and that ability to call something out if there are any issues I see is really fantastic. It's a fantastic commitment that Telstra's making.
Well, good on you, Teresa. Maybe it was okay that you went to Telstra.
Well, I mean, ultimately, ACAN is a very resilient organisation, and they now have an awesome CEO in Andrew Williams. So yeah. I'm very excited that the deputy CEO that when I was there is now the CEO, and also that there have been other opportunities for people to step up as a result of the changes at ACAN.
Growing, exactly. Recently, I was sitting at a Financial Counselling Australian conference when the new Assistant Treasurer, Financial Services Minister Stephen Jones, was speaking. Who did he make specific reference to? None other than Theresa Corbyn. For anyone that knows Theresa, the commitment, the comment from the minister was not surprising, as Theresa seems to know everyone. How do you build that sort of relationships across all parties in government? Because I just don't think it's
hard work. Look, to be honest, you really have to, and obviously some of it's just happened as a measure of time, you know, over time you engage with more people. But I think, okay, it's not just about engaging with more people but having impact. So one of the things that you need to do when you're trying to change things is work out who you need to influence, who are your influencers, that you've got to have your elevator pitch for, that if any time you bumped into them, you're ready to go with it. And you also have to think about when you're elevator pitching, right, it's not just about what you've got to say to them, but how are they going to take an interest in you? What's their motivation? And so Stephen Jones, I engaged with quite a bit in relation to regional telecommunications because he was the shadow assistant minister for comms for quite some time. And so, you know, I worked quite hard to basically make sure that regional consumers' issues were raised and that he was across them, not just the government, but that he was also across those issues. We would do things with politicians, for example, where it wasn't just that we were getting something out of it. You know, we would randomly write to them, not just because we want them to do something, but to just help them. So, by the way, we've got this handy little guide on this. It might help you, you know.
With your constituents.
Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't just about take or what you want them to do, but give something as well. And then the other thing I think that's really important is to basically think outside the square as to who can have influence and what allies you need. So sometimes the people that you don't necessarily engage with naturally might actually be your best ally because they might work with you. So do you remember we ran that big campaign that Alyssa Freeman and Aaron Turner headed up with the 1-800, you know, free calls to mobiles, from mobiles to 1-800 numbers.
That was a really great
campaign. Fantastic. And they did such a brilliant job. And that had been an issue for a long time. We hadn't been able to shift it. And they came up with a fantastic campaign. And as CEO, I was really happy to just basically go, you guys go and make this happen. And they really, really did. And they changed it. So now it's free to bring 1-800 numbers from from mobiles. And given that most people only have a mobile, it's really important. Anyway, one of the allies that they thought of to work with, which was really awesome, was to work with the agency that was selling 1-800 numbers to not-for-profits. So a business. Mm. It wasn't something that consumer organisations really did. And they got them on side and you know, it was a really, really fantastic alliance to work in, you know, to think about that. So you've got to think about outside the square, who are your people that might support you that you wouldn't normally get on side or aren't natural allies, and think about that. And you, like I said, you've got to get to the bottom of what is their motivation as to why they might want to help you, and you're going to have to think outside the square in that regard. And then you might have to think outside the square as to how you actually get them engaged. And in the end, you just have to keep doing stuff and raising the profile of the issue, and sometimes those stakeholders will actually come to you. So you just never know. And I loved yesterday, one of our presenters at this FCAQ conference said something that I really believe in. Plant lots of seeds because you never know which ones are going to grow. And I think that's absolutely true.
Oh, good on you. I think I just really like that relationship stuff because you're so good at it, Theresa.
Oh, thanks.
And that's such a nice, it's such a nice thing to think about because it's about giving, like, making the effort to provide something that they can find useful as well. Yeah. I think that's a really good thing. So I'm coming towards the end, but what would you say But I wanted to ask you a few more questions, and then I wanted to ask you what if you wanted to add anything else. But what would you say to a young person wanting to follow the career path of Teresa Corbin? Should they go into linguistics?
This happened, I know. This happened to me the other day. I was at the 000 call centre, and a young man, he turned out to be 21, and he said that to me. He said, "So what do I do to become the chief customer advocate at Telstra?" And I was a bit flummoxed, actually. But I said to him, well, I didn't actually plan to become the chief customer advocate at Telstra. It's kind of been a journey. And actually, my goal was to have a career in the not-for-profit sector. So I guess the thing is that it's probably quite important for you to just realise why you're doing things and what drives you, because that's what's really going to help you be successful at whatever you want to do. Because if you know what makes you happy, and for me, I know seeing that there have been changes made and that the world's a bit better for some people, it doesn't have to be thousands, even just one person, that I can get job satisfaction. And job satisfaction is actually quite important to me. And so I think it's really important for you to celebrate achievements, even little ones. Even just, you know, oh, I managed to take some time off, or I managed to, you know, maybe it's I managed to get to something face-to-face when that could be a challenge right now for lots of people. You know, I think it's also really important to not sort of be focused on the end game and just focus on doing what you're actually doing now well. Have an end game in mind, like have an idea that, oh, actually, I really want to work in management, or actually I really want to be a really gun researcher or a gun lawyer or whatever. Mm-hmm. But okay, at the moment I'm going to focus on doing this quite well. And don't lose sight of the goal, like keep the goal in mind and try to make sure that you're sort of getting some skills that can help with that. But also put yourself out there a little bit, you know, and talk to people that you might not otherwise talk to, because it's your networks that actually help you get places in the end.
Yeah, I think the networks, and even though people don't like talking about networks and networking, I think, like you said, once you've been in work for such a long time, you just get to know people. Yeah. You get to have a relationship with them, and it really helps you when you're trying to achieve something to be able to call on those people to actually get those
and
outcomes.
Use your mentors, like get some mentors. Mm. Get one or two mentors. And you know, actually ask them, will you mentor me? And and then sit down with them and talk to them where you'd like to go and what you'd like to do, and ask them for some honest feedback. And don't be scared of honest feedback. Sometimes it's uncomfortable, but don't be scared of it.
No.
Don't resist it, and don't sort of go, well, that's not true. You know, maybe you just have to accept, you know, somebody says, this is one of my big failings. Teresa, you interrupt too much. You know, like you talk over me a bit much, you know. Maybe you need to work on that, Teresa.
I think that's a fair point, Teresa, but I also think you have to take things with a grain of salt, because sometimes people might say something to you, you could improve this and you could improve that. Fair enough from their perspective, so, but it's not necessarily the case that you should take on all
So people. I think that's a really important issue. Like, I think you can turn negativity into being too negative.
Mm.
I find, and even now, right, this is something I still struggle with, you have to really honestly and check yourself. Okay, so is the voice in your head the honest truth?
Mm.
And hold yourself accountable on it, right? Because you could be much harder on yourself than you should be, or you could be too easy on yourself on some things. So just your internal voice, hold it to account. Don't be too negative and don't be too positive either.
All right. Well, unless you've got anything else to add, do you? I will close it off.
No, I think that, well, probably what I'd just say is don't judge yourself on other people. Mm. You know, just, you know, you might listen to this interview and go, oh, you know, that's not me. Look at what she's achieved. Well, I'm not afraid to say I'm 55. It's taken a while to be where I'm at now. And I'm a work in progress still, we all are. And I think that it's most important to just show up and make a contribution, even if it's really small, and to just, you know, feel that it can, you are important, you're an important part of whatever you're working on, and you'll continue to be. And just like I said, turn off anything in your mind that is holding you back from things, and don't beat yourself up, because there's plenty of other people in the world who are going to do that for you.
Ah, lovely place to stop. Thank you, Teresa, for sparing the time to talk to me. If you want to find out more about Teresa, there are show notes with each of my episodes, including contact details for each of my guests, on my website, www.lorettacrete.com. Please drop me a line if you have any questions or know of someone who may be interested in being interviewed for this podcast. Until next time, goodbye, friendlies.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.lorettacrete.com.